Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I truly appreciate it. As I mentioned before, the podcast is certainly growing, and that's thanks to you, the listener, for sharing, for liking and thumbs upping and all that kind of stuff. So please keep up the good work. I hope that everyone's holiday season was great. I hope that people got the gifts and most importantly, the love, attention, affection and family support and warmth and attention and rebonding, if you will. And all that. That's, of course, the most important reason for the season. As I mentioned in a previous podcast episode, that I actually lost a family member. So it's really important that we get together these times of year and really understand the purpose of the season and understand that family is the most important thing, that we get around people who will love us, who we love, and just share a good time, share those stories, share those memories, and create stories and create those memories that we can pass down from one generation to the next. So I hope that that all that has gone well for all of you. In addition, I hope that your new year was fantastic. However you brought the new year in, I hope that so far that the new year is going great for you. I hope that you're expecting and doing great things as we are a few days into the new year, 2020. I certainly hope that you have not given up on your new year's resolution so quickly. Continue to strive, continue to push for whatever it is that you have resolved to accomplish in this new year, 2020. Even if you start to slack off a little bit so far, you know, the few days that we've had in, keep going, you know, pick it back up. It doesn't, just because you slacked off doesn't mean you have to stop or doesn't mean that you have to quit, but keep going and keep growing. We have a great episode for you today. We have another doctor, Dr. Kanika Turner out of St. Louis, Missouri. Family medical doctor down there in St. Louis, down in the Lou, as they call it down there. So what happened is that I met Dr. Turner, and I met a number of great, great people at a drug reform conference that I was at in St. Louis, Missouri in November. So the beginning of November, I went to a drug reform conference, and it was very eye-opening, very enlightening. I learned a lot. Being in law enforcement, you tend to look at things through one lens, right? That's the lens of lock them up. Let's have a hard crackdown ideology. So I was fortunate enough to be able to attend this particular conference, and I learned a lot about the other side of the coin of those who are trying to reform not only the police world, but change people's minds about people who use drugs and about drug use in and of itself, right? I did not know that only 10% of the people who actually use drugs develop some type of problem. Now, let me be very clear. I don't believe that people ought to be using illegal drugs. However, my eyes were enlightened to the fact that many people use them. Many people are still functional and all that kind of stuff. So does that mean just because they're dysfunctional that we ought to decriminalize or whatever? No, but it certainly is an eye-opening experience. I certainly enjoyed the conversation that I had with a number of people. I was introduced into this idea of harm reduction. Harm reduction is essentially, let other people explain it who are more well-versed than I, but harm reduction is essentially meeting people where they are, right? So people are using drugs. We've known that for years, for decades, and for centuries. Almost every civilization has had some form of drug use, of mind-altering experience, whether it is alcohol or marijuana or opium or whatever. There's been some type of substance that people have used in order to ease or mask the pain that they have been in. So I think it's very important to meet people where they are and to employ tactics that will actually work. And I'll let the other people, my guests, explain that far better than I. So I met a lot of different people at this particular conference. Dr. Kanika Turner is the first person who was up. I have a number of episodes pre-recorded. Some people I've recorded there at the conference. Matter of fact, Dr. Kanika Turner is one who I recorded at the conference. So as you hear us talking, you'll hear a lot of people in the background and everything like that. We tried to choose the quietest place possible in order for us to do this interview. So you'll hear a lot of people talking, but I think that the quality of the interview is still great, concerning, even considering the background noise that's going on. Once again, I have a lot of different interviews that are going to be coming up. So stay tuned. A lot of great people. We're not just going to be talking about drug reform. We're going to talk about how people are policed in the Philippines. I met a lawyer from over there in the Philippines. I have another former police officer who I need to interview, going to interview, from Great Britain, talk about his time and their undercover police forces in Great Britain. So just a lot of great, great interviews that are going to be coming up. So stay tuned for all that. And once again, I thank you for taking this ride along with us as we look to bridge the gap between the police and the communities that they serve. So once again, let me just say before we get going here, please make sure that you rate, that you subscribe, and that you share these episodes. I thank you all those who have done it. Once again, as I said previously, the month of December 2019, we had the best downloads. More people are tuning in. So I just want to continue to make it grow and to go, right? So we want January 2020 and going forward to be more productive, and we want to gain more listeners. Of course, I want to continue to put out great information so that you'll want to tune in. A couple more just general announcements. Soon we're going to be selling t-shirts. Matter of fact, I want to have them up by the end of January 2020 to be selling t-shirts, even mugs. So that's something I'll be going to be working on, t-shirts and mugs for Captain Hunter's podcast, as well as LMH Police Training and Consulting. Please remember that if you have a training opportunity or if you have a promotional testing opportunity, or you know someone who is in need of an implicit bias instructor or consulting services in leadership and management, I'm your man. Make sure that you hit me up at cptlhunter@gmail.com or hunterpoliceconsulting@gmail.com. Make sure that you go over to the website, hunterpolicetraining.com. Make sure that you check that out. Please remember, we have a Facebook page. We're looking to start some engagement there, looking to start a book club. All that's going to be coming in the year of 2020. So we have t-shirts and mugs that will be going on sale. I have a Facebook page, Captain Hunter's Podcast. You can support the podcast through Venmo, Cash App, PayPal. All of those are CPT L. Hunter. Also remember that you can go over to the Patreon page and subscribe. You know, for just a little bit of dollars a month, your support will go towards helping to keep this podcast going and growing. So head on over to Patreon, become a patron, help support the podcast so that I can keep giving you good quality information and good quality interviews. That's it for as far as the announcements. We all know what it does. Make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share. And just a little bit about Dr. Kanika Turner. She's a family medicine doctor in St. Louis, Missouri. She received her medical degree from St. Louis University. I'll let her explain a little bit more about herself. She's actually a real medical doctor. Stay tuned for the interview. And here we go. Here is the interview with Dr. Kanika Turner as we discuss the opioid epidemic. Okay, so once again, this is Captain Hunter's podcast. We are live coming from St. Louis, from the Lou, right? That's what they call this place.
Right,
the Lou. So I'm here with Dr. Kanika Turner.
Yes.
I said your name right.
Yes.
Okay. Since I got to St. Louis, there's people with some different sounding names. So I interviewed a doctor. I'm not even going to try to say his last name. He was from Puerto Rico, so I couldn't get it. So anyway, so thank you so much for being on Captain
Hunter.
Thanks
for having me. It's really
a pleasure. We talked a little bit before, and I'm just so impressed when I see black female doctors.
Thank you.
I really, really am. So just to tell the story again that I told you before, I took my daughter to the emergency room, and she was like maybe 7 or 8 or something like that. I don't even know what she did. But there was a black female doctor that came in the room, and I'm like, I'm touching my daughter. Hey, this one, you know, look at her. You know, you can do it. You know, and
right.
She was kind of standoffish, and I really didn't appreciate that because I'm asking her, you know, what school did you go to?
Right.
I wasn't trying to hit her on anything. I'm just
right.
like I'm trying to show my daughter.
You're impressed and want to
Yeah.
There's not too many of us. It's a whole other discussion. So definitely.
Yeah. Well, listen, I'll have you back for that discussion because, you know, once again, I want to address the community and I want us as a community to get together and do stuff. Right.
Right.
So I'll definitely call you back if you don't mind. Okay. So we're here at this drug reform conference.
Yeah.
I saw you on a panel, and
And we'll get into that a little bit later. But just tell the audience just a little bit about yourself. Okay. And
perfect. So I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. Did all my training here at St. Louis University School of Medicine. I'm currently the Associate Medical Director at Family Care Health Center. And it's a local FQHC, or Fairly Qualified Health Center, here in St. Louis, St. Louis City. I am also faculty to St. Louis University Department of Family Medicine. And then I'm also a consulting physician to the Missouri State Opioid Response Team, which is the, you know, the funds that Missouri received from SAMHSA to fund prevention, treatment, and outreach. So that's where the other part of my community job come from.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm family medicine trained, but I also provide treatment for SUD, or substance use disorder. So I treat that on a primary care level. I'm actually a big advocate for the integration of primary care with addiction medicine. So on a primary care level, I do believe that, you know, moving forward, our primary care doctors should feel comfortable managing and treating multiple substance use disorders, whether it's alcohol use, tobacco use, cocaine use, because it used to be you had to be referred to a psychiatrist to get that type of training. I think on a primary care level, we can start taking care of the patient holistically and not just, you know, focus on one area and not address the other part.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I guess what else? And here in St. Louis, there are not too many black physicians that's really talking about this opioid epidemic, especially in the black community. So I've kind of become a voice, thankfully. Just, I'm passionate about it. I think just my passion got out across the community, and that's how I ended up being on that panel yesterday. And so I do feel very strong about what we see in our community, not just St. Louis, but all across our country with the number of blacks dying from overdoses now.
Mm-hmm. Now, where did your passion for this come from?
So I always knew I wanted to be a physician. I feel like a lot of us say that, but I did. For me, I'm the first doctor in my family. And when I was a resident in training, there was one particular doctor. His name is Dr. Glick. He's been a huge mentor to me. He's actually been practicing in this area for years, at least 13 years. And a lot of the principles and the things that we're learning now, he actually taught me that when I was a resident. And he's someone who is really into the literature. He's always had like a medication first type treatment approach, harm reduction approach. And so I expressed interest to him that learning how to manage opioid use disorder, that it sparked my interest when I was in residency, and he kind of took me under his wing and mentored me. And for me, I think that was huge in setting me up to do this work, because you do need a mentor in this area. And that's what he did for me. And what it was a patient that he admitted in a hospital who, she was a young girl who was withdrawing, young white girl, and I had to go see her in the emergency department. And watching her cry out, begging me to let her leave just to get some heroin. And her story was, it was really sad. She just had a baby and she was going to the methadone clinic, and she asked to come in early to breastfeed. And they told her no, she had to wait outside, and it was 5 o'clock in the morning. So she got upset, went off on a person. So they told her she had to leave the premises and pretty much dismissed her from the clinic. And so as a result, she went into withdrawal. And that's when I first met her. And it was just, for me, it was just, you know, of course my heart went out to her, this young mother who's trying to do the right thing. And yet somebody told her, you have to stand outside and wait your turn. And she wanted to come inside and breastfeed, you know? And to see her cry out and beg me to let her leave because she wanted to get some more. And I saw the withdrawal symptoms. And of course we started her, we ended up doing an induction in the hospital. So we started her on buprenorphine. And when I went back to check on her after a few doses, she was a different person. And I saw a lot and I learned a lot, and I was able to talk to her. And it was just, you know, what if I would have had that same approach and say, oh, this is another one of those people here. But it was something different for me that caught my attention with that story. I'm just like, how can we treat people like that? And Dr. Glick, he was actually the one who, this was the first one we actually managed together. He pulled me aside. We definitely talked about the medical side, the reward reinforcement pathway, and, you know, how addiction can drive certain behaviors. But to see her stable on buprenorphine, and then just to go and talk to her like a normal person, it sparked my interest. I was like, wow. So that was my first, I guess, initial encounter on the medical side. Growing up for me, just my grandmother grew up, my parents grew up in St. Louis City, and I remember just visiting my grandmother. We'll go see her on the weekends, and just the neighborhood, you know, it was different. So my parents, we grew up in the suburbs, but I would always go visit my grandma and see her, and it was just, you know, it was always around. I remember my grandmother talking to me like, you know, don't walk in front of that house, that's a dope house right there, and don't do this, and, you know, seeing people selling drugs on a corner. And, you know, I remember a few times, well, it was actually one time we were coming from out of town, it was a drive-by, and it was just, you know, like I was exposed to that in my environment. And it's just for me, since God has blessed me to become a physician, I want to be able to help others. Like, I look at it as it's a chronic disease. Our community, unfortunately, with the trauma, there's a lot of untreated PTSD, depression, anxiety. So definitely that goes hand in hand with substance use. So for me, my approach is, you know, these are things that's treatable. And I never knew that. I never knew that, you know, somebody can be treated for alcohol use disorder. My grandfather, never met him, but I was told from my mother that he, you know, he had a drinking problem. And it's just, you know, what if back then, what if he could have been offered Vivitrol? What if he could have been offered, you know, a medicine to help that? You know, we never know. And I just don't feel like growing up, I never heard about treatment for this stuff, even with tobacco use. My mom stopped cold turkey. You know, I didn't know about that time nicotine patches and using Wellbutrin, using medicines to help somebody, you know, with a nicotine use disorder.
Did they have all this type of stuff years ago? I mean,
they did. You know, when I studied this and when those medicines and treatments, they were available. They were. Yeah. And it's just like,
now,
you know,
not
say Vivitrol is new for alcohol use, but still there were things that could have been, you know, offered back then. And to me, it just made me think that, yes, our community have been left out for so many years. And it's not just me, it's a lot of us.
Right.
You know, a lot of us have an uncle or aunt or somebody that we know, and we don't know about that. And it really touches my heart every time I see a patient in the office, because this is somebody's family member, their loved one, and this is where we're withholding information, you know?
Yeah. So that really touches me, the fact of what I would call an orbit. I don't know if that's the right word, but all the people that are around you or people that are being affected. And I can remember my grandmother, you know, as I got older, I wondered why my grandmother and grandfather didn't live together. And then I asked my grandmother, she said, well, your grandfather drank too much.
Mm.
You know, so that story resonates, because you see people who are left out. So
right.
That's why I asked you, did was this accessible to a certain population, right? Black
right.
population, brown population, poor white people, you know,
right.
there's this stuff, you know, these people, other people know about this stuff,
right.
and we don't.
Right,
know?
And even back then, you know, what, you know, we watched those movies like Ray and, you know, The
right.
Temptations, about all of that,
right,
you know.
Right. I can't watch another movie about some successful person, even the white, who was that? Johnny Cash, even
right.
that movie. I'm like, I can't watch another heroin addicted person.
Right.
But go ahead.
Right. No, but I mean, but that's true though. But like, you know, those back then, you know, how the media portrayed, you know, the people who had money were the ones who were able to get access to treatment.
Right.
And this was treatment that should have been accessible to all back then, whether you were a celebrity or not. And we didn't hear about treatment for, you know, opioid use disorder back then. And I know we were discussing before going on the air, you know, about what about this cocaine, you know, epidemic during the 90s, when a lot of our, you know, our people were painted as just drug users, you know, crack babies and, you know, things of that sort, how the media portrayed Black people. And it's like, now let's move forward with opioid use disorder. It's a different light. You know, it's neonatal abstinence syndrome. You know, it's not, you know,
I didn't even know they had a name for it.
Right. We're putting terms to babies, you know, and it's, you know, it's appropriate. You know, that's what we call, you know, mom, when babies who withdraw from opioids. And this is even moms who are stable on Subutex. And I always counsel them that, you know, the baby will withdraw, the baby will go to the NICU. But we, you know, we counsel and educate moms that. But back then, how many Black mothers were being educated, you know, regarding the risk of, you know, drugs and pregnancy? You know, we were automatically stigmatized, automatically, you know, it was our fault. And, you know, it was a moral issue. And, you know, it was really sad, that picture that was painted for our community. And now when we look at it, our community is still seeing the greatest impact. We have more people that's dying. And yes, you know, we are getting funds to tackle and target this. But I do agree that now, since this has spread to the majority, now we have federal funds to treat this. And I tell people, that's absolutely right. Even if you look at the history of this, there's always been a level of drug use or overdose in our community. And for me, it hurts to know that it took for this to happen in order for our people to receive that information, for it to become a majority problem. And I tell people, you know, let's acknowledge that. That's true. Blacks were more likely to be incarcerated from this. We have more black males as in prison for possession charges and things of that sort, you know, compared to whites. We have more, you know, even we talk about the murders and the homicides and the killings. A lot of it is stems with drug use. This is where we are. So I tell people, acknowledge that history, acknowledge that that's there. And then we all need to apologize for how we contributed to this. Somebody, you know, we've all called somebody, or I should say we all, either we thought it, we've been around somebody, we did correct somebody who used stigmatizing terms as, you know, that's a crackhead, that's a dope fiend, or, you know, that's nothing but an alcoholic. We've, you know, use those words. I've been around people that use those words, and we didn't correct anybody because that was the norm for our community. So apologize for that, because we just label somebody because of their disease. I don't label people that have diabetes. I don't, you know, talk about them. You know, we can definitely say that unhealthy eating habits can be one contributor of somebody developing diabetes, but do we focus on that? Do we say and scold people for unhealthy eating habits? No, we get them into seeing a dietitian. We start insulin or medications. We do all those things to help them with that. So let's parallel that same type of treatment or thinking to opioid use disorder. We can get somebody into seeing a peer recovery specialist. We can, you know, start treatment. We can mimic that same model and remove that stigma, because it is a chronic disease. It that's exactly what it is, and we need to approach it and treat that as such.
Do you ever get into the ideas of what brings it about? You talked about it being a disease. We talked about the trauma of, as I talked to the Puerto Rican PhD before, and I talking to you, and the trauma that people of Puerto Rico have suffered, their colonialism, our ancestors, Jim Crow, slavery, and all that trauma. So that's obviously traumatic events will cause people to mask it, want to run away from it, whatever they have to do to get away from the pain that we're dealing with. Is there a biological aspect to it, like alcoholism? People are more prone to do.
Sure, it is. There is, like, you know epigenetics, you know, that family history. Yeah, there is a component of that too. You know, I can't discount that. But if you take that, so there's a component of epigenetics, that family history. Then you have the environment, being raised in an environment like that. For some people, that's their norm. You know, they're around parents who are drinking, or that's their norm for them. That's their let out, their breakaway. That's what some people do. And then you do have the other component. You know, I tell people, it was an issue that came up. Somebody asked me who was, you know, really in church. It's actually a politician asked me, is this a moral issue? And I had to tell him, you know, all of us make decisions. You know, and maybe that was a decision up front, but I'm quite sure that person was not making a decision to think that they're going to become addicted to that, or they're going to think and see, you know, that, oh, if I do this one time, this is going to be my downstream effect. You know, we all make decisions. Even somebody who gambles, do you think that person who first tried that casino, they're probably going, do you think they would have developed an addiction from that? You know, so I can't really get off into saying that, blaming people and say that this is your fault, it's your fault. No, I think it's a society issue, and especially for blacks, you know, just across the board. You know, if you look at housing situations, look at where a majority of the blacks are predominantly located, in poverty infested neighborhoods where the housing may not be the best, as some West County place that you may go, you know, $1 million homes. That's a huge impact on kids that's growing up in an environment like that. You know, if the nearest, you know, grocery store to get healthy food is 20 minutes down the way, or I have to catch 3 buses to get there, yeah, I probably will go to that corner market and get, you know, chips and get something to survive.
Noodles,
you know, but we have to think about that too. I live in an environment that, you know, that we're in, and it's not our fault. I mean, we can even look at the history with housing, how that was in St. Louis. You know, that's not our fault. So it's different things, you know, that can contribute to that. And I was at this conference. I heard one doctor say that it used to be, you know, they were saying that marijuana was the gateway drug. Of course, we dismissed that claim. And I heard this doctor say that trauma is the gateway. And I agree with that. It is. A lot of my patients that I talk to, it's always some type of trauma that was untreated, or they had to deal with it or get over it. Especially a lot of my moms I take care of, or even some of my women, that a lot of it was abusive relationships they were in, or it was a boyfriend that got them started on it, or they were a sex worker. It's, you know, some level they were, you know, raped when they were younger. It was some type of trauma that was there, you know, which is really sad.
It's terrible. As an officer, I was one of those compassion officers, and we would sit in two-man cars a lot of time. And then I would actually ask them, I would actually talk to them, how'd you start doing this? What got you into this? And they would say exactly what you said. They had a boyfriend that started, they were raped, they were molested as kids, and it's survival sex for a lot of them.
Right.
That some of them had pimps and all this kind of stuff. Right. So I can certainly see how trauma, you walk in, I was kind of sheltered. I grew up in a church. I was kind of sheltered. And then I became a police officer at a fairly young age. I was 22. And now here I am thrown into this other world and seeing people for the first time. It's like, what? How did you get? That's why I'm asking. How did you get like this?
Right.
Where did this happen to you at? So, and it was always fascinating to me. And I really developed a heart for it because now I can't be mad at you as a streetwalker because of stuff that your boyfriend did to you or
right.
whatever. And
right.
this is the result of all
that's
that.
Amazing that as a police officer you had that, you know, that outlook on that. It really is. You know, to care for people, like, because people, you know, when you were telling about your podcast, people are afraid of the police. You know, the police are supposed to be there to protect and serve our city.
They're supposed to be.
Right, they're supposed to be. And I will say there are police who unfortunately don't have that outlook. You know, they do, they may try to abuse their position, you know, because they're in that powerful position. But you do have quite a few police officers. And I wish the ones who are just like you will stand up and speak out more, because we do have great police officers that are still passionate about their cities, their communities, but we don't hear that much. You know, we hear about all the bad police officers, the shootings of black people, but we don't hear about the other half. And I'm quite sure there is the same thing, you know, with medicine. People always talk about there's bad doctors and we just want to, you know, just prescribe and give all these people medications. And I'm like, no, I'm not one that's like that.
Right.
But, you know, in any career, any field, I mean, even with lawyers, you know, there's going to be the good and the bad. And I do feel like that across the board with, you know, key careers like that, whether it's physicians, police officers, lawyers, you know, the good crop. We need to start speaking out on issues like this and start letting our community know that we still love you. We're still here for the community and not just let everything be bad, bad, bad.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. That's why I'm doing this podcast. And as we talked about before, sometimes officers are, they won't speak out until they retire.
Right.
Because they get a lot of backlash. I'm just going to be honest. They get a lot
right.
of backlash. You know,
right.
They get teased a lot. You know, it's easier to go along in many
right.
times. And I say that to the detriment. I convict myself of that. Not that I was terrible. I'll never say that I was terrible. But it's just, I can't speak out as much as I did. I can speak out today more than I could before. And as a captain, when I became a captain, I was a third shift supervisor for a long time. And for a while, I was the over internal affairs. So I was able to make some changes and to direct my shift the way that I wanted to go. And I always stood up at roll call and said, I want you to treat these people the way that you want someone to treat your mother, your father, your sister, right? So, and because I hated being getting complaints by people who were complaining about being called names. And that was the biggest complaint all the time is, you know, people would come in and say, listen, I don't care that the officer was doing his job when he towed my car, but did he have to call me a name? Did he have
right.
to? And that today bothers me more than anything else. Do your job, do it professionally. I can't stand when officers swear at people, and I can't stand when...
I agree with you on that, yeah.
There's nothing worse to me. I would write you up in a heartbeat. Don't swear at the people. There's no reason for it. Are
right.
you really that mad? What are you so upset about that
right.
you're swearing at people?
Right.
So.
Yeah, I remember when my significant other, we like first started dating. I remember I was on the phone with him, and he was patrolling. You know, back then, we started dating. It's all, you know, on the phone all the time. And so I was
Now you don't do that anymore? Like, I'll call you back. Stop calling me. I'm at work. I'm calling.
No, we did. He might actually hear this. Okay, I'm sorry. But,
well, maybe I'll edit this out. Take two.
Right. No, for me, you know, I tell him, he actually changed my outlook on police officers, too. And I was on the phone with him, and he was patrolling this area, predominantly white area, and it was in the city. It's actually one of the nicer areas in St. Louis City, and it was a lady, and I heard it was a white lady that walked up to him and said, there's a lady down there that's begging us for money, and of course that's, you know, you can't do that here in St. Louis City. And so he was like, okay, I'll take care of it. So he went down there, and it was a black mother with her kid, and she was just trying to get some food. Like, she was trying to get money to get some food. So he asked her, he's like, you know, what's going on? on? You know, you're asking for money. And she was like, I'm hungry. And, you know, he was like, here, come in here to this place. It was a restaurant right there. And he actually took them in. I heard him. And he told him, he said, here, go order what you want. And I heard the little girl, you know, and I heard, you know, they ordered their food. And they walked back out. And he's like, here, just throw it right here. I'll get your food for you. So I was just listening the whole time. I was very impressed. And so the food came up and he gave it to me. And I heard her in the background. She was like, thank you so much, officer. And the little girl was like, thank you, Mr. Officer. And it's just, you know, she didn't mean any harm. She was trying to feed her daughter. And for her, that may be her way. Let me ask somebody. This is a wealthy white neighborhood. People are jogging down the street. Maybe somebody will help me, which I can understand that type of thinking. But for the other person, they felt offended that this lady, this black lady with her child, asking us for money. Like, how dare you ask us for money?
Yeah, go get a job.
Right. How dare you? You know?
Like, I want to be out here doing
it. And you know what? And he gave them the food, and they walked off. And that was, and yeah, he patrols that area. Haven't seen them back again. But what if that would have been an officer who would have went over there and say, get out of here, or try to arrest her. You know, now she got this baby. You know, it could have been a whole mess where this little girl could have been torn away from her family, her mother, and the only thing it was, they were hungry and just trying to get something to eat. You know, and for me, you know, and he didn't broadcast it. I was just on the phone, but like, and he's so just, you know, just mild-mannered and don't really say anything, but I overheard that, and to me, it's just like, that's what people need to see. That's what,
it's,
you know,
definitely what,
that's what people need to see and hear, and that's compassion, you know?
It's certainly, we need more officers like that,
right,
to do stuff like that, and I do know a lot of times that I know officers who've done that.
Right.
I know
right.
officers who've done that.
Which is huge, and that should be. I know
and
people do things
girl.
Like that. Right. And for her, what, you know, that could have set an impression for her that
for
not
life.
A police officer bad, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So it's things like that all of us need to watch our actions, but especially, you know, with this substance use, when we get back to that, even, you know, I do see police that still mistreat people, especially with, you know, co-occurring behavior health conditions with the depression or schizophrenia.
Mm.
And a lot of times, people just need treatment. It's not necessarily a criminal aspect behind that, but let's give them a try at a treatment, and let's get them connected to treatment resources and not just put them in prison or put them in jail. You know, I heard one prosecuting attorney tell me that if I put somebody in jail, they can get the drugs behind in jail. You know, I'm not doing anything but tearing up families. It's, you know, if they want it, you can still get it. You know, so why not give them a chance while they're out here and seeing what somebody can do? And I definitely agree with that. You know?
I agree with that as well. That's it. Kudos to that prosecutor who told you that.
Yeah.
So you were on the panel. This is where I kind of heard you at. The overdose crisis in our backyards. Can we stop calling it a white overdose crisis?
Mm-hmm.
So I was had a lot of excitement going to this panel, to this discussion, and then when everyone starts talking, my enthusiasm level was just drained.
It went different. Yeah. It did.
But
I think a lot of people on the panel, definitely passionate about, you know, this history. And, you know, racism was a big topic that came up on the panel. And I think, you know, everyone up there, more of them were, I think I was the only medical background. Everyone else had that political background. One, I think one was a lobbyist. And
one was a preacher who kept taking
right.
over. Yeah.
Right.
Could somebody turn his mic off?
Right, I was thinking. Right. Somebody leaned over, was like, oh, this is a preacher. You know, it's going to be
talking for
a long time. So everybody up there was definitely passionate about the topic, but I agree. It was some great topics, some great things that did come out up there. And I think it was more so, what I heard up there from a lot of people was there's still a lot of trauma and hurt that was being expressed on that panel.
Yes.
And I think that's what came forth. And
yes.
So that's why one of my questions were, you know, after we discussed that, so now what? You know, we acknowledge this, and it's absolutely true. I don't want to minimize that at all, but how do we move forward as a people to get past this? What can we do now? We understand how the laws, the Rockefeller laws, all these laws were put in place that discriminated against blacks. So what do we do to move forward? You know, definitely we could have talked about more with, you know, reform, with the political part, doing more lobbying and, you know, going down that route. What can we do as black people? And I think one person did mention on the panel that, you know, our young people, we don't know about the laws, we don't know about the political system. And that's true. I feel like back in the 50s and 60s, you know, that was power right there. That's what Martin Luther King Jr., you know, they went after the law side, changing laws for to better our people. And so that's one other component that we don't speak a lot on. We don't educate our community on how can we be in those halls lobbying, talking to, you know, the Republicans, the Democrats, talking to them about these issues, how these laws have been created to affect blacks. How can we make that change? That was one thing that, you know, maybe we could have went down that route too. My stance, you know, I was talking about the medical field. What can we do in the medical field? Because unfortunately, we too contributed to that. You know, it used to be, and this just wasn't for blacks, but treatment was often given as a last resort. Now, in the state of Missouri, we do treatment up front. As you know, I gave the example with diabetes. But back then, it used to be, it was recommended abstinence-only treatment. In certain areas, there were, you know, methadone came on the scene, it became a gold standard, but there were still a lot of people doing abstinence-only treatment, managing withdrawal symptoms. And what we know now with that, people, once they leave those programs, they're more likely to overdose, to just reduce their tolerance. So they go back using the same amount they were using before, you know, now we just set them up for overdose.
That's almost like the diet kind of thing, yeah. Right? You stop eating for a little while.
Right,
and then next thing you're gonna binge.
Right. You're gonna. Yeah. So, but changing that in the medical field, you know, I'll also tell people too that our doctors, you know, that advocating for more primary care doctors to get this training and to feel comfortable with this to increase access for people. But then we have doctors who are scared to work in this area.
I was about to say that. Yeah, I was thinking about it. Yeah.
Right,
they don't want these druggies.
Right, right. But then you have some doctors who do, you know, now they're under treaty. Now they're concerned about this person coming in saying, I still have cravings, but I just started your medications. But technically, you're under treating this person. They're still having cravings and withdrawals. But as a physician, you didn't take the time out to study, you know, what's the minimal amount to help control, you know, cravings and withdrawals? What are the harms? What are the benefits of this medication? And that's one of the problems, too. You know, when we look across the board, that some physicians are under treating when it comes to opioid use disorder. The other thing, too, when it comes to, you know, it's really sad that as a physician, I can liberally prescribe Percocet, and I may have DEA on me, but I can prescribe Percocet, Dilaudid, with not any bounds, you know, but prescribing buprenorphine that first, second, and third year, I'm limited by the number of patients I can treat. I have to have a special waiver. When you look at methadone, I can't prescribe methadone for opioid use disorder because I need that special waiver. So even just within the healthcare system, we need to make those changes, you know?
So, yeah, forgive the background noise here. We're kind of
at this wonderful conference.
Yeah, it's this wonderful conference here.
But yeah, but things like that, you know, those are conversations we need to change. You know, start in our medical schools, getting this information out to first-year med students, you know, talking to them about addiction medicine, how this is a chronic disease, starting there so we can start to develop, you know, physicians with this knowledge. So even if they don't decide to be a primary care doctor and they want to be their orthopedic surgeon, they have been exposed to how to manage this or who to refer this person to.
Is there resistance to that? Or is there a lobby to, like what you're saying, to try to get this into med schools and to try to talk to them?
Yeah, it is. So, you know, definitely we recognize that. So there's a lot of different schools who are doing it. So St. Louis University, that's the school that I'm at. Our medical student,
university was that?
St. Louis University.
Okay.
Yeah, here in St. Louis. A wonderful school. I went there. they are incorporating that into the medical curriculum. The residents are also getting some training. So our family medicine residents, they actually rotate with me and some of the other physicians in the community who are also treating to get that exposure. And
now,
then,
you teach there, right?
Yeah, I do. So I'm a clinical instructor, so yeah, okay. So I teach med students and residents.
Now, were you instrumental in getting this to them because you're able to teach there?
So I wasn't, there was another doctor, Dr. Fred Rotnick, who, he's at St. Louis University. He was the one who actually did the groundwork for that, and I just kind of just said I want to be a part of it and partake in this. And so, and then with the family medicine residency, I'm a little more closer to the residency program, and so they too know that I was interested in, and I mean the residency in general, they were interested in making sure our residents are trained with getting this information. So like I didn't start it, but definitely I was a huge supporter of it, and I do let the residents come and rotate with me. And while they're with me, you know, I teach them those principles of harm reduction, teach them, you know, look at this as a chronic disease, that you ask this question, what about this, you know, do they have housing and food? You know, we need to address those other resources. So, you know, when I educate, and even with the medical students, when I talk to them, I get medical students from all across the country, you know, when they leave me, I want them to also feel that passion that I do. So even if they don't want to practice and do that, I want them to look beyond somebody coming in and using drugs or, you know, wanting pain medicines. Look beyond that and find out that this is an individual. Listen and learn their story.
So that takes a lot of compassion, and I think that that is one of the key features that we talked about, whether it's your boyfriend who was very compassionate and versus the woman who came up to him and said, listen, I don't want these people, right. essentially,
right,
in my neighborhood.
Right, that's pretty much what it was.
Yeah, so there's a level of compassion that people have, and I would say that that's true even with these doctors. Like I said before, some people don't want those type of people right. coming into my practice. I want to cater to the upper scale, middle right. class
right.
people.
I don't want bad smelling
drug people.
Right, and we can't force every physician to feel like that, but I think if we start embedding this into the medical curriculum, at least get the exposure to them. You know, you can't force a medical student to pick one career over the other, but I do feel they should be exposed to this area because it's affecting multiple people. It's not just only a certain population. All across the country, you know, has been affected. And even, you know, we, you know, what about our, you know, refugee population? You know, St. Louis, we have a huge Bosnian community. You know, we don't even talk about, you know, how to care for somebody, you know, Bosnian or Latino, Latinx. We don't even talk about those communities, you know. So getting that exposure up front can at least lay that foundation or that groundwork moving forward. I think that's what we need to start incorporating into our medical schools. And there is a push and a movement to do that.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
That's good to hear. So, again, my disappointment in this panel was just that I guess I was looking for, I'm just going to say it, white people to be apologetic about how they treated the crack epidemic.
Right.
Did you see Dave Chappelle's special, Sticks and Stones, the Lewis one?
I didn't. I heard about it. I didn't see it.
Okay. Well, I suggest you watch it because it's very, very political. He touches a number of things, attacks everyone, the LGBT, the... no one is off limits. And he talks about how, essentially, he says it in a very comedic way, but there's truth behind it, that he doesn't care about this opioid epidemic because you didn't care about us when we were going through our crack. Now, I understand it sounds very rough, but I think he was trying to get people to think about what happened to us in comparison to what's going on now. And this touchy feel, and I'm not saying it's bad, and I agree that we should do something about it. But we should have done something about the crack epidemic. And if another plague hits us in 10 years or 5 years, hits us that's primarily towards African Americans or to the Latin people or to Puerto Rican people, you know, with the hurricanes, whatever it is, understand that these things can happen to you as well.
Right.
And I just wanted, number one, an apology.
Yeah.
And number two, I wanted to say, listen, we need to learn and do better from this
and
understand some things. And that's what I was looking for.
Right. And that's kind of, you know, at the beginning we were talking when I said, you know, I felt like, you know, we acknowledged the hurt up on that panel, but, you know, the next step, right, apologize, because that's how we're going to be able to move forward. And I say apologize how all of us have dealt with it. And you're right. And it's definitely with the, you know, the white community, the medical community, the criminal justice community.
And there were black people in that, too.
Right.
There were black politicians who pushed for these get 10 ounces or whatever, getting life sentences.
Right.
There are black politicians who pushed for that.
I agree.
You know, so it's just been crazy all across the board.
Right.
And now... some drug company has to pay like $640 million or something like that.
Right.
And that money, we could have used that money to save ourselves and to upgrade our neighborhoods and all that.
I agree with you. I definitely agree. But I do hear that a lot. And one thing, and kind of what you're saying, you know, apologize. But then the next step would be let's, you know, use all of our resources. You know, this happened, but now we got all of this money to make some changes. Why don't we capitalize on it? Maybe some of that money, you know, we can push down a political avenue to, you know, look at our laws and, you know, create some new laws or make things more fair and equitable across the board. So maybe, you know, that can be one thing that, you know, we should do with some of these funds. And then the next avenue, let's look at treatment. You know, how are we doing with treatment? You know, going all the way back, you know, with the doctors and then with the type of treatment and then doing community outreach, getting information out there. Because although we create that, how many people in our community are actually reading, you know, the New York Times or reading the Washington Post to even find out about some of this information? You know, we got to get into the community, you know, where people are being affected. You know, even, you know, now I'm doing a little bit more media outreach you know, I was going around and do some trainings in St. Louis City, St. Louis County, educating and training churches or even black-owned businesses. And, you know, somebody made a comment to me, like, you know, I'm talking to the loved ones or family members. I'm not necessarily talking to people who are actively using. So I'm missing a whole slew of people. One person was saying, you know, this is great that you're doing the church trainings. Nobody, you know, no one knocked it. But somebody who just used the 6 o'clock this morning, they're not in church at 9 o'clock. I'm like, you know what? You got a good point. You know, and my thing with that was, you know, to definitely, our churches and our community has always been the pillars for our community, our foundation. A lot of people go back to the church, you know, and the idea behind doing the church trainings is to, you know, train and educate our pastors and deacons and ministers, because they are the ones who a lot of times doing the counseling. So if they know the information about where to go for treatment, that treatment is an option for somebody, you know, and then also, you know, with language, not being stigmatizing to somebody, not saying, you know, oh, you addict this, you know. And I tell people, like, you know, let's erase that word from our vocabulary, because it is stigmatizing, and, you know, and it's actually still hurtful to call somebody an addict. And if you're talking to your pastor, you want your pastor to call you an addict? No, you know, don't label me behind it. I'm a human being. I'm coming to you for help, wanting counseling. So as a pastor who's talking to people, I want our pastors to feel knowledgeable, knowing how we've transformed the way we deliver this type of health care, at least in the state of Missouri, and then where to go. So that was, you know, that initial approach to train the churches. But then the second hand with that would be getting into the community. As someone else stated, you know, I need to get, you know, I go to the barbershops, the beauty shops, that's another avenue, but really getting into the community, to people who may only, you know, who don't go to church services, or, you know, the same people who may not pick up and read a local newspaper, or they, you know, they may listen to the radio or something. So I was on the radio yesterday talking exactly about this, but using other media outlets to get this same message across, because I tell people, our messaging is going to look different to the white community compared to the black community. And that's the other area we need to start focusing on, our messaging, our delivery to our community, making sure we have that same access to treatment resources.
So one, I know we made a joke, or at least I made a joke about the pastor speaking for a long time. But I do agree with what he was saying as far as, you know, keeping banker's hours.
Yeah, that's true. He made a good point.
You know, going to these people, you know, between the hours of 11 p.m. and 4 a.m., where they are, and hitting them where they are. And I think that, I do think that was very important.
Yeah, he definitely did, because I know, like, he came and talked to me a few times. And his program is great. So he, just people know that he goes out on the street between the hours of 10 a.m. and 2 to 4 a.m. and he give food to people, he counsel them, talk to them, give them a Narcan and naloxone on the street. So that's, you know, that's his nightlife, it's called Nightlife Ministries. So that's what he does, which is awesome. But I agree that, you know, a lot of us are open from 8 to 5. If somebody is desperately wanting to seek treatment, you know, you have that window of opportunity that's there. And if it's 3 a.m. in the morning, where do you send somebody? You know, we can't flood our emergency departments, you know, with that. Those are the only ones who's probably really open at that time, but we can't really, you know, go that route. But can we educate? Maybe can we have a small subset at an emergency department? I don't know. I'm just throwing out ideas. But, you know, where do we go? And I remember I was talking to him. He's doing more harm reduction talk. But I did tell him, like, you know, if you're talking to somebody, tell them to buy the Suboxone and, you know, the buprenorphine instead of the heroin. You know, those are things that you can tell people, like, look, I know you know, instead of getting a heroin or the fentanyl, get the Suboxone, get the buprenorphine, go buy that off the street, if, you know, until you can get in. So
we you can have buy to, it off the street?
Oh yeah. People, yeah, I have had people. You can. Yep, you can.
Okay.
You know, it came up, and I get it, it's a community in which people try to help each other. So it was a paper that came out that looked at this whole issue with diverting drugs and, you know, people selling their medications and things of that sort. But it was a paper that came out that also looked at, you know, with people, they share their blood pressure medications, people share birth control pills, people.
Yeah, I did know that. I know,
right,
people.
And even
doing
with
that.
Right,
yeah.
And people, yeah. And even with antibiotics, you know, people will take, you know, a few doses till they feel fine, and then they'll say the rest, keep it in a medicine cabinet, and then let's say baby's supposed to come over who, you know, may need an antibiotic, you'll give that with them. So I think that one component, at least for me, I knew growing up in my family, I knew, you know, people say medicine because somebody may need it. And I think it's the same type of concept with Suboxone, buprenorphine on the street. People know that if I can't get the heroin or the fentanyl, I don't want to go into drug sickness or withdrawal, so I'll buy the Suboxone so I don't feel drug sick. And a lot of times for people, that's what's actually driving the use, is I don't want to feel sick. And there are people who can go to work a 9-to-5, and they may use it at nighttime, and you may not ever know. But for a lot of people, that's what's driving the continued use, is that I don't want to feel sick. It's not that I'm trying to get high. I don't want to feel this drug sickness. Withdrawal is horrible. It's horrible. It's, you know, stomach cramping. And
we've seen many people.
Yeah, it's bad. And yeah. So, you know, as a person that's using it, if I can just get a little bit, you know, a hold of something to make my symptoms go away, that's what I'm gonna do. So, you know, topics like that, and you know, and that can be controversial for some people. That's harm reduction. You know, harm reduction is meeting people where they are, and we want to save a life. As long as you are alive, I can continue to counsel you and talk to you, and you know, and bring up, are you ready for treatment? Okay, you're not. We're gonna take this naloxone with you. You know, use with somebody. Don't use alone. Stagger your doses. If you are gonna use, you know, snort. That's safer than using IV. Or how about this? Go buy clean. You know, get some clean needles and syringes. Go exchange out the ones you use for, you know, for new and clean ones. So different things like that. And also with that idea, you know, decreasing risk, you know, transmission for HIV and Hep C. You know, that's another idea, you know, with the syringes, with doing that, because we can also, one way that we can decrease the transmission of HIV and Hep C and even Hep B for that cause.
That seems so controversial. And I'm just going to put on my... I'm not.
Oh, because that's right. You are. Was a police officer.
Right. No, right. So I'm going to put on my police officer conservative hat. Yeah. I'm not conservative. I'm not liberal either. I'm just whatever. So, I mean, you're giving out syringes. You're teaching people. I talked to the other doctor. He said you teach people how to shoot up. You're
safe
giving out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all this.
It's the same way with safe sex. And we tell people, if you're going to have sex, use a condom.
Well, but super, super, super conservative people would say, well, listen, they deserve what they get. You use drugs, this is what you get. You have unsafe, unprotected sex. You deserve what happens to you. So some people would just see them as you, this community where I'm at, coddling people and not telling them to straighten up and fly right, essentially. Right? Pick yourself up by your bootstraps boots.
Right, and I think, you know, just to discuss that, that doesn't work, because we've done it for years. We tell people, you know, the Just Say No project.
Right.
You know, just say no to drugs. Look where we are today. Did that work?
Right.
The DARE program. I went through the DARE program. A lot of my colleagues went through the DARE program. Did that really work? You know, so I think we need to change up our dialogue, change up what we're telling people, because saying straighten up and fly right, or, you know, just don't do that, or that's bad. You know, if people are going to use... I want them to be alive. That's how I can, as a physician, that's how I can take care of you. Once you die, I can't do that anymore. You know, and for me, that's my, you know, I love talking about harm reduction, because, you know, if people are going to use, yes, I want you to be safe about it, because I don't want people to get transmitted, you know, to transmit HIV and Hep C, you know, all those infectious diseases. I want people to stay alive if you are going to do it, you know, or keep some naloxone. Keep that with you. So that way, if somebody overdosed, you can save somebody's life and reverse it, you know. But it's a different type of thinking, but it's coming from meeting people where they are so we can save a life. And I think once you look at it like that, and, you know, if it was your loved one, your sister, your brother, you would not want your sibling to die. And if somebody can give that information to your sibling, and you might say, like, don't do that, you know, I don't want you to do that, but we have to meet people where they are. You know, we can no longer just point the finger and have that paternalistic, don't do that, that's bad. You know, we have to change up our dialogue to reach people now.
This whole conference has been so fascinating to me. I really have learned a lot. Like I said, I was on the other side, but just coming here and when I heard about, and I'm going to display a grand amount of ignorance here, is that I thought that the war on drugs was really just a U.S. thing, right? Mm-hmm. Then I went to a panel where there was people from Britain and from
the
Philippines and Brazil. And one person was saying that, I forget which panel I was at, but they were saying that there was no heroin problem essentially in Russia. And once they started their war on drugs, it exploded in Russia, right? The heroin problem exploded. And because people were driven underground, their HIV it exploded there as well,
right,
the
right.
cases of HIV, So I think that this is really important work, and it's something that I never thought about. I thought this is what we're supposed to do. We just arrest our way out of these problems, and it turns out we create a bigger problem, you know. And we would always joke as police officers, you know, if we arrest this guy, you know, next week there'll be two more people ready to take a spot, or, you know, there's a gang killing over territory and stuff, and there's more people taking a spot. And after a while, you start to see this isn't working, these methods of hardcore, you know, fist pounding on the table, stop doing it, arrest our way, lock all these people up, but it's just somebody else going to take your spot. Because we aren't addressing, and I'll finish off with this and let you comment, is we're not dealing with the social aspects of it, right? The poverty that they're dealing with, the trauma that they're dealing with, and all that kind of stuff. So it's really taking care, and it really does make so much sense. If you take the trauma away, or give them treatment for the trauma, or you fix the poverty situation, you know, this $10 an hour, $15 hour jobs, all that kind of stuff, this isn't helping people when the rents are going up.
Right.
You know, it just makes so much sense to fix all these social issues, so therefore we can fix these internal mechanisms that people have for self-healing and self-medication.
Right. Now, I agree. We have to change up our approach. And even, you know, with me, like, I'm a primary care doctor, and when patients come to me, that are actively using, you know, I always let them know. It's like, just be upfront with me. You know, just let me know what's going on. That's how I can best help you. We call it, we're getting it, we don't want to use the term relapse, we say a recurrence. And as a physician, if it's a disease, I understand it. You know, I expect that there may be times where somebody may have a recurrence. You know, just going back into an environment, that can be a trigger for somebody. But understanding how the brain works, understanding those pathways with reward, reinforcement, and dopamine being released, and, you know, that being the feel-good hormone. So, you know, understanding that as a physician, it helps me to be able to provide the best care for my patients. And a lot of times they do, they let me know. You know, one girl told me her previous, you know, pimp came over and she let him in and she was doing great. And that was her weakness. Of course, she let him in, and she told him that she was on the bench with, you know, cocaine, and definitely he had some fentanyl in there. But she ended up coming back to me, and she told me the whole story. And I was like, you know what? I'm glad you're here. Let's go ahead and test you for STIs. Let's restart your Suboxone. And I think for her, she was really shocked. I guess she thought maybe, you know, I was going to say something. But no, like, to me, like, I'm not going to kick you out for that.
Yeah,
right. You know, you came to see me for help, you know, and as a physician. To me, like, that's another thing, too. I can't see how some physicians just discharge people from their practice for, you know, they're coming, you're offering treatment, but yet their drug screen may show a few other things. That's a discussion starter for me. If they're coming for me and I see their drug screen, they, you know, show other substances in there, I don't get upset at that. To me, it makes me think as a physician, A, am I under-treating your symptoms? Do I need to, you know, do I have you at the maximum dose I can put you on? Maybe you have another disorder, a cocaine use disorder that I'm not even trying to target. You know, maybe something else is going on. So for me, it's a discussion starter. It's not a penalty. It's not, you know, punitive and saying, well, because of this, you got to, you know, get kicked out of my practice. No, I don't do that. Because I also feel like, too, as long as you're coming to see me as your physician, your primary care doctor, I can take care of you. I can assist that. If you're out in the street and, you know, no connection, anything can happen to anybody. But at my clinic, you know, I really love where I work. I have community health workers that work with me. And so if somebody needs housing or transportation, even, you know, some things with school, I can grab one of my community health workers and say, hey, this person is homeless. Can we find some shelter? Can you call around and see, you know, who have some beds available, or, you know, get a list of places? I have my peer recovery specialist who come in and see all my patients. I can touch base with her. Hey, this is what just happened, traumatic event. You know, go and do motivational interviewing, or just go and sit with her, talk to her, see what's going on. So I have, you know, those additional resources, because it does. It takes a team, not just one person, but as a physician, because I tell all my patients, just talk to me. Let me know. That's how I can best help you. And I know every physician is not going to have that same type of thinking, but, you know, we got to think about the patient is first. We go to school with medical school with this do no harm type mentality, and we need to apply that across the board. Do no harm. Help our patients, and the patient is first, and think about the patient.
Well, I'm glad you take that seriously. Once again, I was another panel. It might have been that one where they were saying that the medical community completely negated their responsibility towards do no harm when it came to African
Americans. Yeah, it was that one. Yeah.
With the,
it was
and I thought that was profound as well.
Right.
And that's what I want to hear. I just whatever
reason.
That's
true, right?
It's definitely true.
Right, I agree. I felt like there could have been, you know, I kind of felt the panel was going to go the direction. So we had a prep call before that, and it was... It was quite interesting on how to call. and I think, and it was kind of sad, like the moderator got pretty much booted off the stage.
Right, yeah, she got booted. But those are, I mean, obviously you can't see it, but the moderator and the panel just...
Who was white. She was white.
She was the only white person
right,
on
the only white one, but... But she actually wrote a really great paper by Chicago Urban League called Whitewash.
Oh yes, I did write that down.
Yeah, she I think she co-authored that. But it's actually a really great paper, supporting blacks, saying that we need to look at this as a public health issue. It's actually a pretty good paper. And to me, you know, I don't think she's racist or anything like that. The concern was when she brought up the issue was, you know, respectability politics, and I think that's what triggered, you know, my fellow panelists.
I don't even know what that term means. I've heard it so many times. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, even on a phone call, I think, you know, I think for a lot of the with the panelists, it kind of triggered, you know, that was kind of a racist type term, saying, you know, respectability factor, and, you know, how the one panelist like, you know, I'm free. I don't have to abide by white laws or white politics. So I don't think she was saying that, you know, that she's going to blatantly disobey those laws, but I think there's a going thing that the laws that are created are disproportionately affecting blacks. They're not fair and equal laws to help support blacks. And I wasn't, not all laws are like that.
Right.
But I think that was the thing. And on a phone call, it came up with, you know, let's not even go there. So one person said on a phone call, you know, is this going to be one of those panels where we just got to be all respectable and, you know, and play the part? And I don't want to be a part of it. And they're like, no, it's not a part of that. That's not what this is about. And I really think our moderator, I think she meant well. I definitely do. But I think, you know, as stated, I think there were certain things that we could have addressed. Definitely acknowledging that hurt, which came up, and I think that took up majority of the panel's time. But then taking it to the next step, that apologetic component, that should have, you know, we should have talked about that, how all of us, you know, and the one guy, he also alluded to that too, how it's black politicians who also contributed to this. You know, what about those? What about black leaders that we vote into office who then, you know, support the majority instead of thinking about, you know, the black community? There was another part, and then, you know, talking about later on the resources. I think we spent so much time talking about the history of this and the hurt and the damage that I don't think we got to the real nitty gritty discussion of that panel. Definitely, it probably could have went on longer than that, but I do think there are still some benefits, you know, to hear everyone's viewpoint, to you know, let the audience see that, you know, there's still a lot of hurt behind that, still a lot of passion behind, you know, what happened to our community. I mean, I was looking at some of the audience members, their faces, when people were talking, and a lot of people were shocked, like they never heard some of that stuff. So maybe that information needed to, you know, go out that way.
We definitely don't get an education in this country. James Baldwin, the writer from the 60s, he said one time, he said it in the 1980s, he's an older guy, he said that white people really need to learn their history. And I remember watching this on YouTube saying, what is this guy talking about? I mean, I looked up to James Baldwin and what is he talking about? White people know their history. They know Abraham Lincoln. They know. But then as I thought about it, they really don't understand every single aspect of slavery, every single aspect of Jim Crow, and what was really going on.
The impact.
Yeah, they don't understand.
And a lot of stuff, you know, because it wasn't until I got into this field I even learned about the Rockefeller laws, or even, you know, and even just like at the beginning, the laws, you know, originally with heroin once being legal, and then it became illegal. You know, I didn't know anything about that, but we don't talk about that. And I think that's another thing, too, in our school systems. The history that's taught to our kids is a selected history.
Right.
You know, they don't get how this country was really built. Like, we selectively
make America
pick,
great again.
Right, pretty much, right. But we select what we teach our kids, you know. And they may take, you know, a black history class in college, or, you know, high schools may have that. But, you know, and I remember, you know, of course, Black History Month. I know, like, that's a whole controversial there. But, like, why don't we get the real history? You know, I went to this racial equity seminar. And, like, the first day and a half was spent on, I guess, unlearning what we thought our history was and relearning what our history was. And it was actually, it was unbiased. It was, you know, the impact on the Vietnamese, on the blacks. And, you know, so it was kind of just a walk through time and not just only focus on one area. But it was a lot of stuff that I learned that I didn't even know about, you know. But it was actually a really good conference. And there's a book, I think it's like the real U.S. history. It's like it's a nice thick book. And there's this podcast too, of a doctor who it's like an hour podcast, in which is actually pretty good, in which he discussed the real history in the United States. And I think that's another start too, that we need to talk about that stuff, you know, and not just only talk about Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson. And we need to talk about this stuff. And of course, Martin Luther King, don't get me wrong, I love hearing about him, but there were other activists that was around during that time that we don't hear about. Yeah. You know, it was a whole movement that...
I was in my 30s when I heard about Stokely Carmichael.
Yeah, yeah, and it's just like...
Why is that?
Right, it's, you know, and don't get me wrong, we still need to talk about Martin Luther King Jr. And, you know, he was awesome. We still need to hear about that. But what about everybody else who helped contribute back then, too? You know, right. We need to know that history as well.
I definitely agree. I can go on and on about this. So I don't want to take too much more of your time.
Oh, no, it's fine. This is awesome. I agree with you on the panel. And I just think, you know, with the overdose crisis that what we're seeing across the country, you know, first, you know, when I tell people that it's a drug poisoning, you know, we're putting fentanyl is purposely, you know, poisoning a drug supply. So now, we did do
a seminar about that, and mm-hmm. I got to be honest with you, as a captain, I was not tuned in to the whole. I'm going to be honest, I wasn't tuned in. But so fentanyl was something that the dealers are putting in there to cut it to make it more
Someone
potent.
So fentanyl itself is more potent. It's about 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin. And so that's what's actually one of the reasons why we're seeing this rise in overdose deaths, is because of the fentanyl is so potent. That's what's going into the drug supply now. So let's say if somebody who originally, you know, they only, you know, substance use disorder is cocaine use, well, it may be some fentanyl in there. And part of it is, you know, where it's made, you know, with the table. They're not, you know, being nice and neat and separating. We only do make the cocaine over here. I only do the fentanyl here. You know, it's being mixed. And so, you know, that's where you're seeing some of that at. And so that's one huge difference. You know, back then in, you know, the 50s and 60s, it was heroin. So to me, I feel like our community, we adapted. We learned how to survive with it just being heroin. But now we see a rise in older black men that's dying at a higher rate because we don't know how to deal with fentanyl anymore. You know, we don't know how to deal with it. It's not just heroin. It's fentanyl, which is really, really potent. And you know, and that's one of the problems. You know, I think somebody made a comment yesterday on the panel. It's the same thing we've been here before. Yes, we've been here before, but not with fentanyl. We haven't been here with fentanyl, and that's what's explaining for the rise in overdose deaths across the country. And with, you know, going back to the harm reduction, talking to our community. You know, I did a focus group with a group of active, you know, drug users who were black, and some of the myths that circulated in the community on how to reverse an overdose, they're seeing that it's not working. Maybe it worked for her when it's still they tried, but it's not working. You know, and I tell people with that focus group, you know, naloxone is the only way to really, the safest way, I would say this, to reverse the overdose. People have tried multiple things, you know, hitting, slapping people, putting them in a bathtub full of ice. I heard one person say they keep mustard in a refrigerator, and if he was using it, he'll pour mustard in the mouth and the nose to reverse the overdose. But our community learned how to develop these strategies to help save their buddy, you know?
Wow, okay.
And so at the focus group, I was talking about, you know, how to use naloxone, keep it on you, where to get it from, you know, that's how you can, you know, reverse overdose.
Now, they're giving these out in certain places now, right?
Right. So we, so here in Missouri, you can get it from your local pharmacy without a prescription. So we had a one-time prescription written by Dr. Randall, who, I'm blanking on his, he's like big time in Missouri. I can't even think of his actual title, but he's the medical director. Oh, I feel so bad. I don't know his. Okay, anyway, so he wrote a one-time prescription, so somebody can go to our pharmacy and, you know, request or, you know, want to get naloxone without a prescription.
Are there limitations to it? Obviously, can't.
So insurance companies are covering it, okay. Things of that sort. And so one of the problems, if you don't have insurance, you know, how can you get access to it? So you have a lot of different places here that can, and that's distributing this. So Mo Networks, so I actually sit on their board. Board. They're a wonderful organization. It's, you know, all about harm reduction. They do a lot of community outreach, community work. And their organization alone supplied about 40% of the naloxone across the state. So they do track those numbers. And so, and that's like a place located in South City, St. Louis. And when people can go there to get it. At my clinic, when they come see me, I make sure all my patients get it. If I'm treating for chronic pain, and it's not opiate use disorder, if you get, you know, on oxycodone, Percocet, I still sing you with naloxone. People that I treat with active addiction, I make sure they have it. And when I do my church trainings, I leave a supply at the churches. So one of the things with the churches, with those trainings, I help churches develop an overdose response plan, because either, you know, it may not be an overdose at the church, but it may be in a local community or right next to it, or maybe, you know, a family member at home. And so I train churches on how to develop this overdose response plan, and I leave a supply of naloxone at the church for them to have. And so trying to, you know, flood our communities with the naloxone is one, you know, one way we can save a life. But then I always tell people, don't forget about the treatment aspect. We want to save a life with naloxone, but let's also take a step back and start talking about treatment options too, so people know that treatment is available. And if you're not ready, you know, to go into treatment, then, you know, make sure you have the naloxone with you as well.
Now, what would make a person not ready? Right, they're saying, listen, I enjoy being on the edge of death.
Right, they may just feel like
I'm not trying to be funny.
Right. But I mean, they may just, they're just not ready. And I think one thing too, we're transforming, because on the medical side, it used to be you had to go to like an inpatient facility, stay 30, 45 days to get, you know, either we start medications there. I think, you know, on the street they say get clean. You know, we do medication assisted treatment. That's kind, you know, that's becoming a gold standard across the country. But we do outpatient treatment now. So everyone don't have to go away to a facility for 30, 60, 90 days to get treatment. You can actually go to a clinic, whether it's a treatment center, primary care center, you know, to start on your medications the same way we do with diabetes and hypertension. So that's one way that we're changing and destigmatizing treatment, is that you don't have to be sent away to a facility. You can go to an office-based treatment.
So is the resistance a lot of times because they don't want to go away?
I think some of it could be that, you know, thinking that if I go away, and people don't know that we don't need, you know, to be sent away. I heard somebody say, we need to get more beds. And to me, we need more doctors that want to treat to increase access. You know, we can, if there's so many doctors that's treating on an outpatient basis, we can increase the number of patients that we're seeing, and everyone may, you know, don't need that bed. But changing up, you know, the community perception of what this treatment looked like. And a lot of it stems from, you know, those movies with Ray and Temptations. It was always painted. Somebody went to a treatment facility, stayed there, and then they were released. And that's not how we're approaching treatment now. And even, you know, with, you know, induction for opiate use disorder, I do more home-based inductions. And so there's office-based and home-based. So office-based, somebody have to come in, be in withdrawal. You have to observe, you know, normally they're staying there 2 to 3 hours. You're starting the buprenorphine in the clinic. Starting off, when I was new to this, I did more of that, you know, because people was actually coming in, being in withdrawal. But now, you know, I do more office-based induction. So they may have, you know, just used at 10 o'clock. Their appointment was at 11. And they're coming to see me, you know, I'll ask them, when was the last time you used? Okay, well, you know, you're going to go into withdrawal probably about 10 to 12 hours after the last time you used. This is how you're going to start, you know, your induction at home. Take these tablets. I want you to repeat this every 30 minutes to an hour till you get up to this dose. And tomorrow, I want you to get your dose to this. So it's a little bit different than before. And I have my peer recovery specialist reach out to see how the induction go. And starting off with inductions, I just see them more frequently in the clinic. And it's more so for me to make sure, A, am I, you know, controlling your symptoms? You're not having any cravings or withdrawal. You know, we can address the housing, the food, we can address other things. So starting off, I'll see you more frequently, but it's more so I want to see you to make sure I'm getting you safe, so I'm stabilizing the disease. So like, that's a completely different way, you know, how we're treating on the medical side, that our community needs to know that as well.
Your practice is not focused on this, right?
So we're a primary care clinic. So we have, you know, adult medicine, we have pediatric care, we do OB care. We have some providers who do not provide treatment for SUD, so substance use disorders. Right now we have 13 waiver physicians that provide care for SUD, OUD at our clinic. And so it's a primary care clinic. So people come in, you know,
How do the other physicians that you work with view you taking care of these people with the SUDs, is that what you call it?
Yes, substance use disorders, yeah. at my clinic, I think one thing is I really love the physicians I work with, because we all, A, want to work in urban underserved practice. I think all of us automatically have this compassionate type care ingrained in us. So I think for us, there's haven't been any like backlash from providers being upset because you have some who want to treat and some who are not. And I think the other thing, the one doctor I discussed earlier, Dr. Glick, who was my mentor, he's been there for years. I mean, he's been doing this for, you know, 12, 13 years, and that's, you know, where he's at. So I think with him being there, it kind of already, you know, people are used to this practice, and now we just expanded it to other physicians who are now doing that. So, yeah, and I'm the only one. There's, I provide treatment for pregnant women, so which is unique at my clinic. It used to be they will, you know, see a high-risk doctor. So I still consult a high-risk doctor at least one time during the pregnancy, but for the most part, I'm also taking care of moms on a primary care level, so that way they don't have to, you know, go to that high-risk doctor. There are times where I need to refer, transfer, and I will, and it's just more so because, you know what, you know, we're seeing things on the ultrasound or seeing things that, you know, you may need a little bit higher level care, somebody to help co-manage with me and monitor what's going on. But for the most part, a lot of these moms can be taken care of on a primary care level for those who feel comfortable. And I love OB. And so for me, you know, if something doesn't look right, you know, there's a problem, I can identify that and I can call one of my colleagues or one of the local universities here and say, hey, can you get this person in? This is what I'm seeing on ultrasound. You know, we have that collaboration.
Very nice.
Yes, I love what I do.
It sounds like it. That's important. So I want to end off with this. I don't keep saying that, but is there a difference? And I heard this, and I want to see if I'm hearing this right. Is there a difference between the methadone and the other medication?
Oh, buprenorphine. So
is one that they give to the more common people, and the one that's used for the higher,
right?
So for the more ritzy people.
Right. So all those are treatment options. So. So I can answer that on a few different levels. So on a primary care level, so there's a special waiver you need to prescribe methadone. So that's why you have methadone maintenance clinics in which people go every day to get their dose observed. But on a primary care level, you know, we can use buprenorphine or, you know, Subutex, Suboxone. We can use that. So more doctors can, you know, get their waiver to prescribe that. And as far as with treatment, we look across the board. Methadone was, you know, the gold standard. That's what was being used. And then we had the introduction of Suboxone or buprenorphine that came on the scene. And now we're using that to help stabilize, you know, OUD. So for me, I start patients on that. A lot of my patients do just well with the Suboxone. We use Subutex for either for pregnant women or for those who are breastfeeding.
Now, you, just to be clear about this, so this Suboxone, you give them and they take it home. Mm-hmm. And then they'll use it once a day or whatever they're
right,
using.
Right, once or twice a day, right. And if some, it can be, you know, written as once a day, twice a day, three times a day, right.
And so, and they're
pill
trusted. They're trusted to have that at home. And then would this, again, be this stigma? I want to ask this question right, because what I'm understanding is that we'll give this gold standard, the methadone, to these druggies, and I'm, you know, using the air quotes. No, seriously.
Right.
And we'll make them, we'll humiliate them by making them go to these outpatient treatment centers every day. I worked as an extra duty assignment. It was my job once a week to go to this clinic and stand by, make sure that there was no fights and all that kind of stuff in the parking lot. So that's my experience with that. So I want to make sure that, so they regulated to that, to those people, and to us ritzier, higher ranking people in society.
Right, is there a difference?
There is a difference in the treatment because of your social status is what I'm asking.
Oh, no, you know what, back then, I can see your point. I would say now, no, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that, you know, because of this social status, you have to get methadone versus this social status, you know, you can get Suboxone. I wouldn't say that. So the medications actually work a little bit differently. So methadone, you know, so it's a full agonist, meaning that on those receptors, that it fully saturates the receptor, versus Suboxone is a partial agonist. So it's a little bit of protective benefit with Suboxone. So Suboxone can be offered, you know, if the physician is waiver, you know, at a treatment center or a primary care clinic, you know, we can start somebody on that one, you know, no matter what your background is. Now, just for me, I don't have the special training to do methadone. So if someone prefers methadone over Suboxone, then I would have to send them to a methadone clinic. But there's no, I guess, discrimination into, you know, which medicine is better, you know, or compared to the other. No, it's not.
Well, and actually, I didn't mean better. I meant just the
right,
stigma.
Right, because methadone was the one that's been around for years.
Right.
You know, that's the one that a lot of people are aware of. Even on the panel, you know, it was kept being references to methadone. You know, and I was really trying to get the message out. You know, Suboxone, buprenorphine, that works really well. We don't have to only talk about methadone. You know, people can do just well with maintaining their recovery on Suboxone. You know, or the buprenorphine. We don't have to push for everyone going down a methadone route. There's other options. I mean, we have Vivitrol. That's the injectable one. That's another option. And some people like that one. It's an antagonist. I have some reserves with using Vivitrol because it is an antagonist. Some people can do really well with Vivitrol. It's an injection you get every 30 days. 21 to 30 days, they'll come into the office, get the injection. There are some people that can do really well. And Vivitrol is actually the one I mentioned earlier, is FDA approved for alcohol use disorder and opioid use disorder. But there are some people who may not be candidates for that because Vivitrol, it can lower your tolerance to that. So let's say if somebody's been on Vivitrol, they had a recurrence, and they went back to using that same, you know, 2-3 grams they were using before, there's a higher likelihood they can have a overdose from that. So some people, they may not be candidates for Vivitrol, and some may be. Now, I know in the correctional system, they use Vivitrol a lot because it's an antagonist. But for me, I mean, I think we need to be using buprenorphine across the board. You know, and then there are some people who may need methadone. If somebody failed buprenorphine, they may need methadone. But I think right now, to increase access, to get more people into treatment, that we do need to be start using more buprenorphine. And going back when you said that it's on the streets, and people who, you know, are active drug users, they know that the Suboxone will stabilize my cravings and my withdrawals. And if I can't get that, I'm going to go buy the Suboxone, buy the buprenorphine. People know that. And so for me, I have had people who, unfortunately, the wait list to get into clinics may be, you know, a month, 2-3 months out. And there are people that will buy the Suboxone off the street. And I had a guy come in, and of course off the street, it was like $15 a pill. I just had to increase his dose. He had maintained his recovery for a month, only buying that. And I just had to increase his dose because he was still having cravings. And he's actually doing just great. And he got insurance, you know, and now with his copay, he's paying like $15 a month for a full supply. But you do see that people, if there's a long wait list, that they will. They'll start themselves on the street and purposely buy the Suboxone because I can't even get into a doctor. But let me do this. This is the safer route. And for me, I have no problem with that.
Oh, well, that's good. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I truly appreciated this.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
It definitely was.
I hope it was helpful. I feel like, yeah. We talked a lot. I think it was a lot more of a social discussion, but,
That's what it's all about. I want to get this information out there. So.
Right.
And a doctor, that preacher we were talking about was a Reverend Kenneth McCoy,
yeah.
Founder and director of Nightlife Ministries in St. Louis. So
mm-hmm.
People can reach out to him and see what he's doing as far as, and maybe they can be emulated in different cities.
Because he is doing some great work. I know they kind of jumped on him.
They kind of jumped on him. Because he kept talking, taking over the mic and stuff.
Yeah,
one time he stood up and
I'm like, that's because he's a preacher.
There's no organ in here, man. Sit down, man.
He did say that. But, you know, he's passionate about it. He's definitely passionate. But, yeah, they should. His program is also saving lives. Yeah. So I can say he's...
I believe that.
Yeah.
I believe that.
I mean, he's finding people behind the trash cans and talking to them, you know. And
that's important work.
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing that work that... And a lot of us are scared to do so. But thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you for being on. So do you have any papers we can read, or where else can we find your information at? Or?
I don't have any papers.
Okay. Well, listen, I don't know.
Yeah, just practice medicine.
Okay.
Nothing yet. I know some people, they've been asking me to get like some social media stuff going, like an Instagram, a Twitter, you know, to post some of this knowledge.
Yeah, course, I actually think it's a very good idea. You're going into churches and barbershops, you know, just kind of put it out there, you know.
Yeah, I agree. It just came up. So right now I'm doing, like I said, some media outreach with our local radio stations. But I agree. You know, if I should start, you know, something like that. So yeah, you'll see something from me. I'll send you a text when I set it up.
Okay, very good. Very good.
Well, thank you so much.
No, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Once again, I want to say thank you to my special guest, Dr. Kanika Turner. Thank you so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. I really enjoyed the conversation, and I am definitely going to have her back on the podcast so we can talk about this lack of female Black doctors, because I really think that it's important. I think that it's important to have representation so that when people look at the TV screen, or when they look in magazines, or when they go into a doctor's office, or go into a mechanic's shop, or to a lawyer's office, or you name the profession, right? I think it's great and it's good that we have representation so little kids can see themselves in the professions that they want to be. Coming up, I will also have an interview with a PhD from Springfield College, and we're going to be talking about the importance of representation and how Native Americans are failing to see themselves in representation on TV and et cetera, et cetera. So representation is important. So once again, I just want to thank Dr. Kanika Turner for being on Captain Hunter's podcast. And we're going to look forward to having her back. She was very knowledgeable concerning the opioid crisis, and there's so much more to talk about. And so I'm just looking to have another conversation with her. So that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share this episode. Head on over to the Patreon page to become a patron. Remember, you can also support the podcast through Cash App, Venmo, and PayPal. And be on the lookout for my mugs and my t-shirts, and start a discussion over at Captain Hunter's podcast on Facebook. Follow me on Instagram, CPTL Hunter. Facebook, Lawrence Hunter, CPTL Hunter, LMH Police Training and Consulting. Instagram, Twitter, CPTL Hunter, and all that, and all that, and all that. So thank you once again. Much love and peace.